Hey guys, just before we jump into the episode today, we would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we record this podcast today. We pay our respects to the elders past and present, and we extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people here today. This episode is brought to you by the Psych Collaborative, our online psychology clinic bringing good quality, accessible therapy to you in the comfort of your own home. Hello, lovely listeners. Today, we are lucky to be sitting down with the lovely Dana to hear about her experience with BPD and complex PTSD. Dana is so passionate about helping others to understand their mental health experiences and hopes that by sharing her story, she can provide further insights and understanding when it comes to challenging diagnoses and breaking the mental health stigma. Just a trigger warning, this episode discusses sexual assault and self-harm, so please skip this episode if this is triggering for you. Dana, welcome to the Psychology Sisters podcast. We are so excited to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about you, Dana. What brings you here?
I'm Dana. I'm 26. I live in Newcastle with my dog. I just came on so that I can have a chat about my journey with mental health, specifically with BPD and complex PTSD. I reached out to the girls and they were happy to have me, so I'm happy to be here.
So, Dana, in true Psychology Sister tradition, what is your pit and peak of the week?
My peak would definitely be that I've started a new job in early childhood, early intervention with the NDIS system, which has been a kind of thing that I've wanted to do for a really long time. So it's really exciting to finally have that position offered to me and get started. So that's definitely my peak. My pit is probably that I've been eating too much Easter egg, Easter chocolate, and now my skin's breaking out.
I feel like that's a peak that turned into a pit. There's nothing wrong
like
with eating chocolate.
It's a good chocolate. Thing, but a bad thing.
Oh, yum. Easter. Easter's coming up. That's exciting.
Yeah, it is. It's very exciting. But my skin's like, no.
Yeah, I feel you on that one. Well, obviously, Dana, we can hear how passionate you are about advocating for mental health. And obviously, you messaged us a while ago and you said that you really want to share your story with us. And obviously, we thought it was so important that you did. Your story was really important. So why do you think, like, talk to us about why it is important to share your story?
I guess I just know from my experience how hard it can be to accept and acknowledge that mental health is a part of so many of our lives, and that so many people do have mental illnesses that they think that they're never ever going to get through. And I just want to show people that it does get better, and that with hard work and a little bit of dedication and going through the really down times and the really up times, it does get better and you can live a normal, healthy life in the end. I never expected that I would even make it past my 21st birthday with the way that my mental health was when I was younger. So to be able to now be 26 and doing so many good things with my life, I think it's just really important to share that with other people that might be feeling like they're in the same boat. I guess that's really where it all stemmed from. Now that I'm happy enough and healthy enough that I can actually share a bit about myself with other people, I guess it's just nice to do that and hopefully help somebody else that's going through that difficult time.
Absolutely. I think that is such a comforting and empowering message that a lot of people will really appreciate hearing from you being so open and candid with your own mental health experience and some of the, I guess, challenging things that you've had to accept, like you say. And when you messaged us, you spoke about experiences with borderline personality disorder and complex post-traumatic stress disorder. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience with BPD? When did you realize that, you know, you were starting to experience symptoms, and how did it all kind of begin for you?
So I didn't get diagnosed with BPD until I was 22, I think. So I actually got diagnosed as manic depressive for most of my teenage life until I got changed to bipolar, as well as having like severe anxiety and that sort of thing. But I started looking at I heard of BPD and I just thought, that just sounds so much like me. And I couldn't really accept the bipolar diagnosis because it was so much more more significant than what I felt like I was dealing with. Like I felt like my smaller issues weren't being recognized because they weren't ticking the scale of the bipolar diagnosis I've been given. So I went to a new doctor, a new psychologist, and just said to her, look, I've heard of this condition called borderline personality disorder. I don't really know anything about it. Can you talk to me and see whether it's something that you think I have, because I think I might have it. So we went through the process of that, and yeah, so some of the things that I experienced with borderline personality disorder was I used to like disassociate quite a lot. I had these just moments of recklessness and impulsivity that just I couldn't explain away. I couldn't understand where it came from because I wasn't like that as a kid either, which is the other thing. I was just participating in really reckless behaviors, and I was self-harming a lot and that sort of thing, and it just didn't feel like what I had been led to believe that bipolar was going to be like from the doctor that I was seeing. So once I got that, sorry, I'm going on a tangent. But yeah, once I spoke to my doctor and explained to her that I thought that I might have BPD rather than bipolar, it just all really started coming together and it made so much more sense to me, and I really could understand what was happening with myself more. Like I ended up with this massive credit card debt because I would do these impulsive spending sprees that I didn't really know about, and I was behaving in ways that were making other people feel that I was just like kind of unhinged in a way, and I could never understand what was happening, and the treatments that I was seeing for the bipolar just weren't helping me at all. So once I started realizing it was borderline personality and understanding where the lack of impulse control and the recklessness and the those sorts of behaviors were coming from, it was a lot easier for me to understand, and in that way obviously it was easier for me to start getting proper help that I actually needed.
I think with borderline personality disorder, it is quite common for it to be misdiagnosed quite a few times. And it's quite frustrating, I can imagine, as the sufferer of borderline personality disorder to have to go through quite a process, right? It does usually take quite a few years for it to get correctly diagnosed, if it ever does at all. So I can really hear that you are probably relieved to hear when it was diagnosed. A lot of people are, but how was that for you, being diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, something that you thought you might have, and then actually hearing the diagnosis?
It was a massive relief. I felt like I was finally being understood properly. I felt like I was finally getting the answers that I really needed. It was really frustrating. I started therapy when I was like 14 or 15. And then to have all these other diagnoses thrown at me, but no one ever actually being able to help me because I wasn't responding to the way that they were trying to help me, because that wasn't what they were trying to treat, wasn't what I actually had and what I was actually living with. So it was definitely a relief. I'd kind of already self-diagnosed myself, to be honest. I'd done like surveys online and I was like, I'm definitely like, this is 100% what it is. It was a massive relief, huge relief. It was a big weight off my shoulders, but it was also quite intimidating because a lot of people don't know a lot about borderline personality disorder. And as soon as you hear anything that has the word personality in it, you think, do I have multiple personalities? Do I have this? Do I have that? Because no one really knows a lot about it. It was, as I said, it was definitely a relief, but it was also pretty scary. There was a lot that I had to learn, and it took a little bit of getting used to that this was something that I was going to live with, but it was also something that I knew was treatable. So it was nice to know that as well.
Absolutely. So it sounds like it was a bit of a roller coaster
to
getting there, but you found some comfort in hearing something that really made sense to what you're experiencing and something that I guess allowed you to further understand some of those behaviors and symptoms that you're experiencing as well, as confronting and daunting as having that diagnosis would have been. I can really hear that there would have been a sense of comfort in being like, oh, finally something that feels like it fits me.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess then in going through that process and being diagnosed with BPD, what was the difference in experiences with CPTSD? What symptoms did you have and what did that feel like for you? And was it a similar process or was it a completely different roller coaster?
The combination of BPD and any type of PTSD, but especially complex PTSD, PTSD is, it's intense. Because a lot of the symptoms overlap so much, but a lot of them are also so contradictory to each other. So I was so impulsive and I'd do these things, but then all of a sudden something would trigger me and trigger my PTSD and it would just result in these chaotic behavior and outbursts and like just a lot of very intense emotions and things as well. The thing with my PTSD, I developed it from a pretty young age. We're in the process of doing trauma mapping for EMDR at the moment, but we'll talk about that a little bit soon. So that's been very confronting to hear everything, but it all stemmed from some assault, sexual abusive behavior that started when I was a young teenager. Mm. But a lot of it I'd actually completely forgotten about. So I'd never considered that I would be somebody that would have PTSD because, as obviously you're aware, but some of the listeners might not be, a lot of the time when you have these traumatic experiences so long, your body just completely blocks them out. Mm. And then you have these behaviors that are triggered behaviors like, you know, someone might touch you or you might be in a certain spot or you see something or, you know, there's a smell and all of a sudden you're just in this fit of anxiety and panic and you can't really understand what it's from. So until we got the BPD under like kind of diagnosed, a lot of the behaviors that did turn out to actually be based on the CPTSD were being attributed to that BPD. So until we started investigating and my psychologist went to me, hang on a second, like we never speak about between the ages of like 14 and 18, let's talk about those and see what happened in that time and see if there's something there that might actually be able to account for these triggered behaviors that you're having, that we really started to realize that there was even anything there to go into. So the process of the CPTSD diagnosis was a lot more confronting. It was something that I hadn't even considered was something that I was going to have or ever have to live with. So yeah, it was much more confronting, especially having to talk about everything in a very upfront and almost like reliving it kind of way, because as I said, I had blocked out so much. So then having to kind of force myself to remember it and then go into it and realize that there was something else going on was really intimidating. Yeah.
That must have been such a process for you. It must have been quite an emotionally draining process.
Yeah,
you
know? It was. Absolutely. It took a big toll on my life, but in a better way than what it did when I was younger, if that makes any sense at all. Like, I think it took a toll on me because it was just overwhelming. It wasn't actually traumatic for me to get diagnosed. It wasn't upsetting me because I was worried that there was something wrong with me. It was upsetting because I had to realize that everything was actually, like, there was a lot of stuff that I could attribute to things that had happened to me and things that I was living with. And it was kind of a sigh of relief, but also just a sigh of this, why? But yeah, it was definitely challenging, but just for a different way than it was in the beginning.
Yeah. Just going back to the timeline, sorry, what was the timeline when you think about your BPD diagnosis and your complex PTSD diagnosis? Were they at a similar time or were they different?
Quite similar. I think I got diagnosed with CPTSD about 6 months after I got diagnosed. And the real like kicker for the CPTSD was when I started doing dialectal behavioral therapy, and it was in a group setting, and there were rules about what you could and couldn't speak about in there. But obviously we're all there with BPD. A lot of people had impulse control issues that they were working on. So occasionally things would get brought up, and the mediator for it actually brought to my attention that when certain things were mentioned, she could see that something changed in me. And that's when I brought it up with my doctor. So yeah, it was only about 6 months after my BPD, but it was all very intense. It was a very intense 12 months.
Absolutely. I can imagine. Yeah. And I guess what would have made a lot of sense to you, I guess, hearing your around your CPTSD. Sorry. Just cut that out, Kat. See, it happens all the time. I follow my words all the time.
I didn't even know there was a variation of PTSD that had a C in front of it until I got
but
diagnosed.
I don't think like all PTSD is complex. It's funny how like it's like,
it's why, so I mean, interesting.
Is the other
one
not complex? Like it's interesting.
I think the way that my doctor explained it to me was that complex is several events.
Yeah.
And yeah. Regular PTSD, you guys would know that, obviously. Yeah. I don't know why I'm trying to explain that to you.
No, that's really helpful, because it's part of, I guess, the process with being diagnosed is that whole psychoeducation and understanding around what it actually means. Because exactly if you hadn't had been given that education and that information, you wouldn't know. You would just be like, well, I've been given this label and I have no idea what it means. And I think that's part of the confronting kind of making meaning and its acceptance stage of receiving a diagnosis. But I wonder how that would have felt for you in making sense of symptoms of BPD like dissociation and being able to understand and kind of have that insight some of these symptoms, like you said, some of them conflicting, but some of them kind of coincide with BPD from those experiences of trauma. And I can imagine too that it would have been relieving in a way to make sense of those, I guess, outside of a label, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. Definitely like the combination of the two things, as I said, was quite intense, but it's hard because you don't want to blame behaviors on trauma. You don't want to say, oh, I did this because this happened to me. I think that just takes away from the importance of recovery and the importance of processing what does happen to you. But in a way, it was nice in the interim to be able to have kind of an immediate answer to it, like a bit of a immediate way to go, okay, so yes, I've got BPD, but I also am experiencing this because of stuff that's happened to me in the past, but or you know, certain things would happen or certain things I would do. And it was nice to kind of have some sort of an understanding as to why my behaviors changed so suddenly when I did get triggered by things, and why it was so intense and so scary for me, because I didn't understand what was happening to me either. And people on the outside didn't understand. So once I got a bit of an idea of where these things had stemmed from, it was quite eye-opening. Don't think I answered that question properly, but
no, you did. Absolutely you did. And I think what you just said there is really, I think, quite powerful and profound, is that it's not about saying, well, because this happened to me, I behave like this, but it's about not this is what's happened to me and I'm like this. It's about making meaning of what happened to you and understanding how you experienced those events. And then I guess how they've caused you to react or how you learnt to adapt with what happened to you.
Yeah.
I do want to ask, obviously you've had so much going on in such a short time frame, Dana, and I can just imagine, you know, we haven't even touched on what else was going on in your life, but I can imagine there was 100 other things you had going on as a, was this in early adulthood? Was this?
So the BPD specifically and the CPTSD specifically, I think I got, I was like 21 or 22 when this all started happening. So it was only about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. But the majority of the traumas, the majority of the really intense behaviors, the majority of the really challenging stuff happened probably when I was like 18 to 23, 24. Mm-hmm. The last 2 years have been really good, but a lot of the a lot of the worst of it was when I was in my late teens. So I'm pretty much starting over at the moment. I'm quite behind society's timeline because I spent a lot of the time that I should have been setting myself up for life just kind of
surviving
basically. Yeah, that's what my psychologist calls it. She always says that to me and I always get all cringy when she says it, and she's like, you're a survivor, Dana, and I'm like, thank you.
Oh no, I hope that wasn't a trigger for you.
No, not at all. It's just so funny when she says it because I associate myself so much with everything that's happened to me, but I also don't, it's, and this isn't a tell me that I'm doing really great thing. It's just I just feel like I'm doing how I should be doing. This is how I should have been 5, 6 years ago, you know. I'm just really glad that I was able to get through it and am able to now be a normal functioning human being. You know, I still have my days, I still have my moments, but I don't like to consider myself to be anything astounding because I've gotten through it. And I think, like, back to the whole why I want to share and everything like that, I want people to realize that you don't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to then turn into rainbows and butterflies for it to be a recovery and for it to be survival. It can just be getting into an actual life, you know, pushing through and realizing that you want to be alive and that you can do it.
Absolutely. And that I think, and a lot of people that have been through mental health and trauma will relate to that hope for normality. I just want things to be normal. I just want to achieve a normal, healthy, full functioning life where I'm doing a little bit more than just surviving.
Yeah, exactly.
So you've touched on treatment quite a fair bit, Dana, and I want to ask you, obviously there has been, it sounds like there's been lots of different modalities as well. You said group work and EMDR you're exploring at the moment, and you've had a psychologist and a doctor. So what has treatment looked like for you? What I guess has been important about treatment? What has really helped you, I guess, through your journey? I hope that's not another word that you don't like, but through the
journey. It's not about me not liking it, I promise. It just makes me giggle because it's like I'm talking to psychologists and psychotherapists and that sort of thing. So it's making me go, oh, I'm in therapy again.
Like, where do they learn these words?
So treatment for me has been pretty all over the place, but also quite consistent, if that makes any sense at all. I've been medicated since I was 14. They chucked me on a whole bunch of stuff to try and calm me down, and you know, it's the way that it kind of was 10 years ago. I hope it's not anymore. So I've been medicated since then. I was on really high doses of medication for a really long time and kind of forced into therapy when I was a teenager. I didn't want to see a therapist when I was a teenager. My poor mum was paying for me to see a psychiatrist, and I literally just sit there and he'd say, right, we're doing a 15-minute session today because you obviously don't want to talk and I'm not going to charge your mum for more than that. And I was like, sweet. Catch ya, I'm out. But eventually I started opening up and I went to a proper psychologist. So I was doing one-on-one therapy for a really long time. And that's the therapist that I'm still seeing now. So I saw her for quite a while before we went down this path of BPD and CPTSD and stuff. And what else did I do? Yeah, so I did therapy. I did go into hospital a couple of times, but that wasn't exactly a therapeutic experience. That was more when things got really heightened and I just couldn't do it. But then once I started seeing my psychologist more, we were able to bring my medication down. So I only take one tablet now, which is really exciting. And I just, it's more just for a peace of mind with anything. And then after, as I said, just after I got the BPD diagnosis, I started doing dialectical behavioral therapy. And that was really, really helpful. I really enjoyed it. Honestly, I think it's something that should be taught in schools to a certain degree. I think it's a really beneficial thing for pretty much anybody. So I think it's something that a lot of people could benefit from. So I did DBT for about 6 months, I think. I was going weekly. It was really good. But then I had to go back to work on the day that I was doing DBT, and I kind of just went back to work instead of doing a second round of it, which I really wish I had done a second round of it. But, you know, you got to do what you got to do. And then I just went back to one-on-one therapy with my psychologist. And we have started EMDR like 3 times now. But something just keeps happening that we haven't been able to keep the consistent, fortnightly visits up, which is what we have to do for EMDR to be successful. But we've done all the memory mapping and the trauma work in advance for that. We have done a lot of trauma work in one-on-one therapy, which has been, a lot of like, reframing. The way that I think about myself is the main kind of like overarching subject of the therapy that I do with her one-on-one. But yeah, we're going to get into EMDR properly again in a couple of weeks once I get settled into the new job and can go consistently. So
I did want to ask if you feel comfortable too. You did speak highly of DBT, and obviously it is such a wonderful tool. Just for anyone who perhaps does experience borderline personality disorder or complex PTSD, or just anyone who's interested, in your words, I'd love to hear it from your perspective. Talk to us about what DBT is and I guess a general like idea of how it has helped you, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, my memory is a bit fuzzy sometimes, so I don't remember exactly like the key things that they probably told me about it. But the basics of it is that it teaches you to use less challenging or dangerous or impulsive kind of behaviors to manage the way that you're feeling about certain things. There's a couple of different areas. I can't remember exactly what the titles were for them. But essentially it'll teaches you alternatives. That's the word I was looking for behaviors that you're experiencing due to your BPD or whatever any other mood disorder that you're living with. So some of the examples would be like for people that live with self-harm, they give you a lot of different alternatives to that, like squeeze an ice cube or go for a run or things that still give you that same. So it's not teaching you behaviors to do instead of something, it's teaching you behaviors to do that will still stimulate the emotion or the sensation that you're trying to get without being hazardous, basically. So we learned a lot about a lot of what we learned was about that sort of thing. A lot of it was also like ways to reframe the way that you react to certain things. Behavioral therapy is the easiest way to just sum it up. It's really based on teaching and learning behaviors to learning how to change your behaviors to be more beneficial to you rather than damaging.
Yeah,
basically, I guess. It's hard to explain to people, but It's it definitely, yeah, I think the main thing is, yeah, the basic overview is to find, it helped me personally to find alternatives to managing behaviors that I was doing.
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of teaches you another method that you can use when you have really overwhelming emotions.
Yep.
And something that you might have learnt in DBT is the TIP acronym. So
yes.
Yeah.
That was one of the ones I was trying to think of. I couldn't get it into my head.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's the temperature, intense exercise, pace breathing, and progressive muscle relaxation.
Yeah.
Yeah, wonderful. And funnily enough, I'm sure Kat too, but Kat used to work in schools and I still work in schools. And I actually do teach the DBT TIP acronym to children because I agree. I think it's a fundamental skill to learn for anyone, regardless of whether you have a chronic mental illness or if you are just going through the ebbs and flows of life, learning alternative methods to cope with stress or distress is super fundamental and really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people don't even realize that they're doing certain behaviors or having certain reactions to things. And I think if we were given these, as you said, fundamental, this way of learning from a base, how to deal with our emotions and our distress in a healthy manner, I think it would be a lot easier for a lot of people to realize that the difference between behaviors that are healthy and behaviors that aren't. So I think people fall into this this habit of dealing with things in an unhealthy way because they're not taught any other way. I know for a fact I didn't have a bad childhood or anything like that. I didn't learn the behaviors that I engaged in from other people. I learned the behaviors because that was the way that I knew how to cope with things. And if I had been given that basis of ways to deal with things, like the TIP acronym is the perfect example, maybe things would have been slightly different. Obviously, I can't change what's happened, but I think that if more people are aware that there are alternatives, then, you know, it could be better.
Dana, what has helped you the most to accept and understand your diagnoses?
I think definitely time and processing it. I think at first it's even if you're prepared for a diagnosis, it's still going to be intense to hear something about yourself. So I think taking the time and putting the energy into your recovery as well was something that really helped me. I wasn't going to help myself when I was 15, but once I was 21 and 22 and I wanted to help myself, I really put the time and the energy and the effort into it. As you just heard with all the different therapies and things, I think, yeah, the time, the energy and the effort and realizing that it's such an important thing to do was definitely what helped me the most. Definitely the time, the support from my loved ones obviously really helped, but no matter how much support you get, sometimes it's not what you need to help yourself. Sometimes you just need that time and that energy that you put into it to actually do the work. No matter how many people you've got around you telling you that you're doing well and it's going to be all right, until you can process that for yourself and really take the time, again, I've said that word like six times, but take the time and the energy to really work on yourself. That's definitely been what's helped me the most.
And I think obviously you've mentioned that you have been, it sounds very independent in, you know, obviously you've had a good support network, but it sounds like there's been a motivation for you, an intrinsic motivation for wanting to receive help and receive treatment. I think that's such a really powerful thing that you've done, Dana. I know a lot of, obviously as therapists, we harp on about support networks, but to want to know that it, to do it on your own and to want to do it on your own and to understand the importance of having support, but also the importance of you putting in the work and the energy. I think that's a really powerful thing to consider, especially if you're someone who's listening who does experience BPD or any mental health concern, is there is the work to put in. And I just, you're such a testament to that, Dana. It sounds like you really put in the work and the energy and the time, and that is really something really, really special and really, yeah, quite profound, as Amy said before.
I think sorry, I think a lot of people that do have BPD or any of these kind of misunderstood, even things as common as depression and anxiety, not in a like, I want people to think of me like this way, but in a, I want to prove that I'm better than what I've behaved like. And I messed up so much when I was younger because I was so sick. And I think a lot of the intrinsic motivation really just comes from the fact that I wanted to show everyone that, and myself, that I could actually get better. Mm. As I said, like, I never even planned to make it past my 21st birthday. So to prove to myself and other people that I could do that, that was a lot. So, yeah, and I wanted to show those people in my life that have supported me for so long that it was worth it to support me.
Mm. Just on that, Dana, you talked about your biggest supporters. Who have been your biggest supporters sort of throughout your life?
My mum, always, yeah. She's the best. My best friend Tiana's been around for the majority of it as well. My dad has done his best. He's a dad. He doesn't really quite understand that it's a real thing, but he's learnt a lot over the years to make sure that he can support me. But, yeah, definitely my mum and Tiana and Bear, who was hanging around before. My dog Bear it sounds so cheesy, but he I got him when I was really, really unwell. And for like the first 2 years, he was essentially just my therapy dog. So, even though he can't support me in a human way, he's supported me in a lot of ways, but, yeah, definitely my mum and Tiana have been the main supports.
And just for context, I need to give context to the listeners who can't see Bear. Bear is a beautiful, fluffy, majestic, handsome golden retriever. I think I've seen in a long baby. Time.
Yeah, he's gorgeous. Absolutely beautiful. I got him tattooed on me and I don't have my mum or Tiana, so obviously he's had an impact.
Favoritism, perhaps.
Yeah.
Oh, he sounds like he's been such a wonderful support. Pets are, aren't they? There's something unrivaled about pets for support, right? Human support is obviously absolutely. In its own way fantastic, but support from a pet is just unrivaled, and that's why there is therapy animals, because they provide such a different comfort to what humans often can.
Absolutely.
And they don't ask you if you're okay. They just let you cuddle them while you're upset. That's sometimes all you need.
Absolutely. They provide that just attunement to you. They just hear you and they can sense when you're out of sorts or when you maybe just need them to be close to you and give you that warmth that, as Kat said, is often unrivaled by our loved ones, even though they try their best. I think pets, especially dogs, there's something about dogs. Mm. They just provide that that warmth and that connection to just sit with, which is just so lovely and such a great support. And Dana, I just wanted to go back to what you said about your process in understanding and accepting your diagnosis. And I guess what's sitting with me is that feeling that you wanted to prove that you were worth the process. And I think that's something that a lot of people in long-term therapy will relate to, is that it is not a linear process. And a lot of people can look back on past behaviors, especially how they might have responded when they were going through, I guess, the peak of understanding their symptomology or working through trauma or even before that, maybe when you were adapting and surviving and responding in the only way you knew how at the time. Reflecting back on that can sometimes be really hard, and we can sometimes look back on parts of ourselves when we were maybe responding in places that we really didn't understand yet. That can be a challenge and that can just be such a huge, huge thing to work through. And as Kat said, that's really hard work as well. And I think a lot of people, like I said, that are going through long-term therapy or maybe even just starting the therapeutic process will really relate to in that it is long-term work. And I think what you're providing listeners when they're hearing you speak is hope. Yeah, that if they put in the work, yeah, if they trust in the process, and maybe you, like you said, you maybe have to swap and change a few different therapies and a few different frameworks to find something that really fits for you and something that really works for you. But by, I guess, making that commitment to yourself and putting in the work and the time and practicing those alternative methods that you can get to what is normal for you.
Yeah.
Or what feels absolutely normal. Yeah, which I
think you said that so perfectly.
Oh no, I think you said it perfectly. Absolutely. I think, yeah, it's very, very inspiring and very touching to hear. And I think you said before about being normal but not wanting to be extraordinary or not wanting to be amazing. But I think a lot of people will hear that and think, wow, this is just, it gives me so much hope. So, and I definitely felt that. So I wanted to reflect that and acknowledge that for you because
thank you.
Yeah, I think it is just really, really amazing to sit with, to be honest.
That's all I want to do. That's the only reason I talk about it.
Yeah.
Like I don't talk about it so people put me on a pedestal. I just want people to realize that you get better.
Yeah, and I think that's such a beautiful realization. One of the other things that we really wanted to discuss with you, because I think this is another aspect around mental health that we are all on the same page with, and that is breaking down stigma and really opening up the conversations around mental health so that we can advocate for, you know, normalizing that mental health is something that everyone goes through at one stage or another. And I guess we wondered how stigma may have impacted on your experiences of mental health.
Yeah, look, I think something to be aware of for everyone, especially and other listeners as well, is that stigma doesn't just come from other people. All the time we have stigma about our own mental health and about how we have our own ideas in our heads about what things mean. But look, I've copped being called a psycho and being crazy and being this unpredictable person for so long. Not so much anymore because I'm a lot more managed now. So, but for so long, I didn't even understand what was going on with myself. And the stigma surrounding it was that, you know, she's just nuts, you know, she's got mental health issues, or she's you know, she's self-harming, she's crazy, she's doing this for attention, or she's not actually sick, she's this, she's that, this didn't happen to her, you know. I think it's something that I'm sure that most people listening to this are going to hear this and go, yep, that's, you know, I've heard that as well. And then so the name calling and the shame that I've copped over the years, these things, it just made me feel even worse about myself, and it made me believe these things about myself too. So I think that's a massive impact that the stigma surrounding it has had. But not even just from that, I think as well the stigma that society has about mental health has made it really difficult for people to want to reach out and get the assistance that they actually need. Because, you know, you go to a GP, a lot of the time they're going to shove you on some medication. You know, they're going to give you some medication and go, oh, here's five sessions of psychologist. I'm not going to help you find a psychologist. You just go and say, yeah, you tick this box, you've got this condition. So I think that, and there's so much many awareness campaigns and things at the moment, and people talk about how it's not weak to speak and it's, you know, talk to somebody and do this and do that. But the actual reality of it is that the majority of people don't understand the depth that mental illness really does go to. They think of it as this surface level thing. But there's so much more to it than what so many people realize. And then on the contrary, you've got the idea that we're weak, or we need to be treated with some sort of special bubble wrap because we're just so close to, you know, snapping, or we're so close to, you know, going down that dark path again and stuff. And honestly, I think no matter which end of the spectrum people sit on with the stigmatization that they put around people with mental illness, it's just as damaging. So yeah, breaking down the stigma around it and normalizing that more often than not, people that you know are going to be struggling with their mental health issues, whether they've got a diagnosis or not, the majority of people that meet are probably battling with some demons on the inside, and it's probably more the norm to have mental health issues than it is to not. And I think to continue treating people that do have mental illness as if there's something, you know, dangerous or broken about them just reinforces this stigma that we've been led up to believe for so long. I think working in the disability industry as well has really opened my eyes to it even more than it did when I was suffering, because I guess when you're suffering with something, you already feel so bad about yourself that the way that people treat you because of the stigma kind of adds to it, doesn't you? Don't realize just how negative the effects are on you until you see them in other people. So yeah, as I said at the beginning as well, just I think we put so much stigma onto ourselves too, because of the way that we are brought up in society to think of people that do have mental health issues and mental illness. Obviously it's getting better, but you know, yeah, I think it's impacted a lot on my experiences. I think that I've gotten through them pretty well. I think the people that, you know, wanted to stayed around, the people that wanted to brand me as something that I was this psycho person, or that I was, you know, anything else, they didn't stick around and I don't really care. These days I think I surround myself with people that don't stigmatize people with mental illness, so I don't find that I deal with it as much. But yeah, when I was younger and a lot of my friends and family that have suffered with it, I see it a lot and it still definitely exists.
And it's interesting, Dana, when you bring up something such as borderline personality disorder, it sounds quite intimidating, you know, just the label itself, borderline personality disorder.
Absolutely.
Amy and I have talked about this on previous podcasts, is just the label is already brings some stigma, doesn't it? But I think,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, obviously hearing you speak, anyone who hasn't had much experience with borderline personality disorder, you know, people who experience BPD and even complex PTSD and even other personality disorders generally are fully functioning humans in society. They work, they study. Yeah,
exactly.
They're not, you know, in specific, they're not institutionalized all the time. And I think that that's such a stigma as well. Ames and I have spoken about that the stigma's broken down a lot with anxiety and depression, but with something like personality disorders, something like, you know, the other mood disorders, these things and even addictions still are still highly stigmatized, aren't they? And it's interesting that people can participate in Are You Okay
and
share it on their Instagram. But then when it's actually in real life, this discomfort of someone who's not acting the way that you want them to, or it's socially inappropriate, people can't handle that. And I think there is just this dichotomy of society with this, you know, sparkly mental health awareness days, but then when it actually happens in real life, when someone is in your life who's not doing well, or they need the extra support, you suddenly, these people may often feel discomfort and back away or not know how to handle it. And that I can imagine as someone who's suffering is quite frustrating.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, like borderline personality disorder, as I said at the beginning, as soon as people hear personality in anything, they think of, you know, movies like Split, and you know, think of these things that you're just, as if I'm just going to suddenly start talking like a different person, or you know, black out and not and turn into somebody completely different. That's not the way that it works. And then when you add in PTSD to it, people know of PTSD because of you know, veterans and people that have gone through what people deem to actually be significant traumas. They think that, oh, if you've got PTSD, you must have had something really like intense happening. It's like, yep, what happened to me was pretty intense, but it's not what you think deems. It's not what you deem to be intense enough for me to have a have to now live with a traumatic stress disorder, you know. So yeah, I think, as you said, it's all well and good to put up these you know, awareness things for these really common conditions that people live with. And don't get me wrong, they're extremely difficult for people to live with. I will not discount that at all. I also have quite severe anxiety that goes along with my other conditions, and it's really hard. But yeah, there's still a lot of work to do when it comes to breaking down the stigma surrounding mental health, because at the moment it really does just cover those more common things, and people still don't know a lot about other conditions that people live with.
Yeah. Obviously, as someone who's living through this at the moment, there will be people listening, and we actually get this question so much about borderline personality disorder, and I think that's why we want to bring you on today, is there will be people listening who haven't spoken up yet, or who are unsure of where to turn, or feel that maybe they've perhaps Googled their symptoms or done the testing or making a hypothesis in their mind, which we wouldn't recommend, by the way, but just people who perhaps know that there is something going on there. What guidance from your own experience would you share with these people that perhaps are listening, who are perhaps a little afraid to seek support?
I think it's hard, because when you're in that point, you don't want to hear it, but it really doesn't ever get easier if you don't get help. I know you girls are always recommending therapy. I always recommend therapy to everybody as well. But I really do think that it's so important to find somebody that you connect with and you can speak to about what's happening with you. And it doesn't necessarily have to mean that you are ready to fully dive into long-term therapy. It just is an opportunity for you to get what's happening out there and realize that it's okay, and that it's not, doesn't make you any less of a person. I think that the main piece of guidance is to find somebody or some way that you can express yourself and what's happening with you in a healthy way, whether it's to a therapist or a friend or your personal trainer, like somebody that you can get it out to and say, look, this is what I'm living with. I'm concerned about myself. And just try and take that step, because as soon as you verbalize these things, the more that you verbalize it, the more that it starts to become something that you can actually deal with and you can actually live with. But it doesn't get easier without help. It's not something that you have to suffer in silence for. It's not something that you have to try and fix for yourself. It's a medical condition. And it's not saying that just because you think you have BPD or something, you definitely have it. But it's saying that if you're concerned, if you woke up tomorrow morning and you thought, oh, God, I slept a bit funny, I think I might have broken my finger, you're not just going to go, oh, well, I don't want to talk about it though. I'm just going to hide it because, you know, it's not that important. You're going to go, okay, look, I'm kind of can't do anything today because I've broken my finger. I'm going to see somebody about it. And I think a lot of people do contrast mental and physical health like that, and it can be quite demeaning in a way, like it can sound a bit dismissive. But the way that I think about it is that, like, that's what, there's people there that are meant to support you and are meant to help you through this. And if you can utilize them. Doctors can give you discounted psychology appointments. You know, you can reach out to friends that you know have issues. Reach out to people on social media. We're all so involved with social media. Reach out to an influencer or somebody, or a micro influencer that you think is understanding of mental health, and ask them for some suggestions on people they can speak to or people that they can reach out to that are going to help them. It doesn't get better without help is the main takeaway from that.
And I think that is such an important takeaway, is that reaching out in whatever capacity you can is so important in I guess accessing support, so that you can work towards alleviating some of the symptoms, you know, if you're experiencing anxiety or depression or symptoms that you might relate to that Dana is describing. I think also accessing helpful resources like Beyond Blue or Headspace, Lifeline, all those free accessible resources that are available most 24/7 by web chat or by telephone can be really helpful as well. And I think, Dana, another really crucial thing that you touched on is that earlier when you were kind of speaking about your, I guess, therapeutic process, in this is something that you've been working at for a really long time and something that you do put in a lot of consistent time and energy and effort to, because it's important that you do for recovery and to function optimally. And I'm wondering what are some of the things that you might do on a daily basis to really care and look after your mental health in terms of managing some of the symptoms or just overall well-being? Like you mentioned, even for anxiety or stress that you might experience, what are some of the things that you do day to day?
I have Bear, obviously, as I said. I spend a lot of time with him. I take him for a walk every morning or afternoon, take him to the park, that sort of thing. I go to the gym. I find that moving my body really helps to take away some of those heightened emotions that I tend to still feel on a pretty regular basis. Getting outside, eating well, all that stuff that your parents tell you when you're little, it actually really helps a lot. Having a routine is really important for me. That really helps me with managing everything that goes on. Remembering to take my medication on time, because I always forget to do that. But not everyone is medicated, and it's totally okay if you're not medicated as well. That's just something that, you know, I'm very transparent about. It helps me. And, you know, sometimes I journal. It doesn't work that well, but sometimes I just feel like writing everything down. It's something that a lot of people recommend, but I've never really been able to get into it. But I have a gratitude journal, which I write in sometimes. I really like to read. It's really helpful. Just doing things that I know make me feel good. Just, you know, I know that going to the gym makes me feel good, so I make sure that I do that every day. I know that laying in bed and playing puzzles on my iPad makes me feel good sometimes, so I do that as well, you know. I've just managed to find things that help me. I try and speak to my friends every day, make sure that I'm not isolating myself too much, make sure I, you know, get outside on my lunch break. Just try and, it's not that exciting.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Unfortunately.
you're right. Those are all really important things to practice regularly to really care for your mental health. And I guess another important takeaway from that is that not everything is going to work for everyone all the time, that it's about finding things that 100%. Really work for you and help you feel better. Because journaling is a great skill or tool to tap into, but not everyone is going to enjoy it. Same as going to the gym or exercise, different strokes for different folks. And I like that able to kind of reflect on, well, these are the things that really worked for me.
Yeah. I think once you find what does work for you, it's really helpful. But it's not always it doesn't always have to be fancy stuff either. It's not always doing face masks and having rose petal baths and, you know, it doesn't, you see all of it on Instagram. It's all this self-care stuff and it's all beautiful. And it's like, sometimes it's literally just waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning and going to the gym when you don't really feel like it, because you know that come 7 o'clock tonight, it's going to make you feel a lot better.
So sometimes there's some self-care can be difficult but necessary, right? Like
I think absolutely
self-care is this really fluffy term that's thrown around. I know there's something Ames and I've spoken about before, is it's the difficult conversations, it's boundary setting, it's cutting people out of your life, it's the getting up, going to the gym even when you don't want to. I think that's so important to touch on, Dana.
And it's recognizing your own behaviors as well, so
absolutely. Going to therapy.
Yes, go to therapy.
Now, Dana, something we ask all of our lovely guests that come on, that we're lucky enough to have on, is what advice would you give to your younger self?
Look, it'll probably make me emotional when I listen back to the podcast. But I would just tell that young girl that one day she's going to be really proud of herself, and one day she's going to do something and she's going to be somebody that's worth being here, and that she is worth being here when she's going through this as well, but that it's going to get better. And also that one day she's going to realize that all the awful things that have been done to her and all the awful things that she's been through have made her stronger and more resilient than she would have ever been without them. And yeah, it's going to be okay, and she'll get there eventually, and just to keep pushing on, really.
Dana, very profound, powerful way to end the episode. And I know that there will be at least one person listening who will really connect with everything that you've spoken about. And I think there's so much power in you normalizing BPD and complex PTSD. Mm. I think that's where your power is. It's you're normalizing it. You're an everyday person who's going through this. And I just really know that a lot of people will get a lot out of this. So we really thank you so much for coming on and being vulnerable. We know that as therapists, and you know, so it's not easy to be vulnerable and to share a lot of these things. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing, you know.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm just glad that I could come on and that you said yes when I gave you the message.
Of course.
Absolutely. Well, I echo everything that Kat just said. Thank you so much for coming on and being so open in sharing, you know, your personal experiences. I think a lot of people will definitely relate to what you're saying. And I think a lot of people will be moved and inspired by your journey. I know that's a bit of a cringe word, as we kind of discussed, but it is all the process, because it's definitely not an easy one. And like Kat said, I think there's a lot of strength and power in what you have shared today, that is very profound and is very moving. I think that there will be a few tears shed listening back to this episode. I just really, really appreciate your time, and I think a lot of other people will appreciate you opening up and hearing your story as well. And it has been a wonderful story to hear.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's been really nice to be here. You guys are really easy to talk to, which is nice, and I'm just glad that I got to come on and give a little bit of a bit of insight into what it's like.
Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. If you're not already, please follow us on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters. We are also now providing online psychological sessions. For more information, please follow us at The Psych Collaborative. See you next time.